Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Andy King, an actor, writer, and director whose credits include Scare Tactics, FX's Fargo, and Filth City, a comic farce about a crack mayor in a city not unlike Toronto, starring friend of the show Pat Thornton. And Andy returns as the craven J.D. Castlemaine in the fourth season of The Amazing Gale Pyle, launching this Thursday, March 29th on CBC Digital. Andy chose Airplane, the smash 1980 spoof from Jim Abrams, Jerry Zucker, and David Zucker that forged a new kind of comedy based on the loving replication of an existing non-comedic genre. And yeah, that's an analytical reading that removes all the funny from the equation. The movie, though, is nothing but funny. A note-perfect satire of disaster films, with Robert Hayes and Julie Haggerty playing ex-lovers forced back together during a crisis in the sky as a handful of bozos on the ground do their best to help. Featuring Leslie Nielsen, Robert Stack, Lloyd Bridges, and Peter Graves sending up their alpha male careers, and the weirdest cameos from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Ethel Merman in cinema history, it's a funhouse ride that just keeps on giving. There's one small thing. I got the release year wrong like 4 seconds into the conversation because I'm an idiot, and Andy was polite enough not to correct me. Anyway, we got past it. This is someone else's movie.
Well, Airplane's a movie for me that it just goes back to my childhood. I guess I don't even know what year it came out, but
1981 maybe.
81. So I was about 5 years old, four or 5 years old. But I watched a lot of movies as a kid. We got, you know, my friends had a VCR early. There weren't a lot of, we'd go down to the movie store, there weren't a lot, and we were really into comedy. And God, we must have watched it, you know, dozens and dozens of times, just our favorite movie. I can remember my friend Randy Morgan, who works in locations here in Toronto now, and I would just, you know, just consume it over and over again. So we were obsessed with it. We were obsessed with the lines. We were obsessed with everything. But I didn't realize, like, I have kids now, and, you know, my son's 9, my daughter's 7, and I don't know if I still wouldn't show it to them. I don't think. There's just a lot of...
I'm just trying to think about that, yeah. It would be... I saw it in theaters 3 or 4 times, I think. I remember one really crappy day in the winter. I remember it as winter. Maybe, I don't even know. I cut school, took the day and went to the Yorkdale Theater and saw The Empire Strikes Back and Airplane back to back just because.
Was there a lot of hype for Airplane at that time? Like, I mean,
everybody was talking about it. I was 11 maybe or 12. No, wait, I must have been older than that. I was 12 or 13. And, I remember there being a lot of talk at school. I was in junior high and people were just, kids were talking about it constantly because it was a transgressive movie that we could get into. Like, we couldn't have gotten into Animal House. The Blues Brothers had just sort of blown past us, I think, culturally, because I don't think it landed in Canada the way it did in America. Hmm. But Airplane was... We were too young to have known the reference points. We didn't see it as parody. We just saw it as this insane comedy that was funny when it shouldn't be funny.
Yeah.
That, like, casting Robert Stack and Leslie Nielsen and Lloyd Bridges in comic roles that were identical to the roles they used to play, it's a masterstroke.
That is the masterstroke, I think, of the whole film. And just having seen it again recently, just the tone they get with it.
Yeah.
Is unbelievable because, you know, they've got an Elmer Bernstein score and they're bringing these heavyweight actors, you know, from the 60s and 70s into it, and they're playing it straight, and it's the dumbest stuff that's in the world that's happening, but they play it straight. And I think, I mean, that particular vibe, it only occurred to me recently, has a strong influence on stuff that I've done, because it's always about trying to get to the absurd but in a very straight way.
Right.
But just watching it again, I was just blown away. Also, by just how funny it is and how committed they are to every joke. Like, within seconds, I was dying. And they put so much into every joke that they get along the way. And like you, I didn't know it was a parody.
Right.
Apparently, they did parody it off this movie, Zero Hour. Mm-hmm. And they had to end up buying the rights to this movie because they took it so closely.
That's amazing. I did not know that.
Yeah, which is crazy. But I have not seen that movie, so I don't know how close it was. But yeah, for me,
it's dead on. It is the same story. It's kind of incredible. I saw it, I don't know, 20 years ago now, maybe. It was
It was revived because of Airplane. It was like, this is the movie that Airplane was based on, and just circulated briefly. And it's not very good, because now it's broken. Like, it would be like, well, it's like trying to watch Leslie Nielsen in anything dramatic from the 50s or 60s. Right. Like, Forbidden Planet is hard to watch now,
because
he's doing the same thing he does, but it's supposed to be stentorian and serious.
Yeah. Well, and especially with the same plot, I'm sure you're just like, something's missing.
Yeah, it is. Like, the anarchy is missing.
Yeah.
Everybody, when people get food poisoning in Zero Hour, they just kind of slump. It's not as interesting.
Right.
But the way that Airplane uses this completely po-faced, dull idea, you know, you're a pilot, you're traumatized, you have to fly the plane, and spins it into the most just delirious, like, hallucinatory comedy. I had never seen anything like it. And then I caught up a few years later to Kentucky Fried Movie, which has a similar parody sequence of I can't remember the name of the Enter the Dragon parody.
Yeah, it is. But, yeah, it's one of the Bruce Lee movies, obviously.
Yeah. And it's, again, it's a dead-on parody, and it's note perfect, but it's not as good, because Landis is directing it, and there's just a different point of view somehow.
Mm-hmm.
When Zucker, Abrahams, and Zucker get on their own vibe together, they form this. They force us into their brains. Like, it's like you're watching. Oh, what is it? It's like Mystery Science Theater before there was Mystery Science Theater. You're enjoying how bad this movie is, and the movie knows it, and the filmmakers are inviting you into it.
Well, that's a strange thing, though, that you bring up, because, see, it doesn't, in some ways, because the comedy's so absurd, they're winking, but they're also not winking, right? And they're not being that accessible, because, it allows it, the interesting thing about Airplane compared to Kentucky Fried Movie and some of those other ones is it's not just a series of sketches.
Right.
It's very much like a strong, plotted movie, and probably because they stole a plot, but they really commit to that. And it's just amazing to me how they balance so many characters over the course of it. And of course, when I saw it recently, I analyzed just where the, you know, you're always, when you write stuff, you like, oh, where's the plot, or where's act one end? They actually have a very long, it takes a long time for them to get food poisoning.
Yeah.
They spend so much time on Ted Stryker's backstory. And, you know, of course, the Peace Corps and all that stuff. That's and everything right. with Elaine. And they it goes on forever. It's not until like 40 minutes into the movies that anyone gets food poisoning, which you would think would be sort of the end of the first act. So they really, like, they're doing jokes, but they spend a long time building their characters and everything as well, which you don't see in those sketchy movies that are all cut up. And, it was just it was really mind-blowing to see again. I realized how influential it is, too, you know?
Oh, yeah.
The one thing you don't see today, too, I find is just the intense commitment to these jokes. One in particular that struck me was they call Captain Over's wife to tell her that there's been a problem with the plane,
right,
and she should get down to the airport. Like, that's the only purpose of the scene.
Yeah.
And she's, of course, in bed with a horse. She's supposed to be having an affair, but she's in bed with a horse. And she's like, I got to go down, and the horse whinnies. But it's a real horse. And it's like a fully real horse. And then the horse, like, turns at the right moment and whinnies, and just, as a filmmaker, you know how complex that would have been and how many people would have said, like, do we have to have a real horse? Like, just put a head in. It's a 5-second scene. It's a 10-second scene. But they go for it.
Yeah.
And it just makes it that much better.
I'm thinking of stuff like, well, just the amazing structure of the running gags, the pacing for those two. It knows when to leave the cabin of the airplane. It knows when to go to a bigger sequence. It knows when to pull back and focus. And maybe it is simply because the rhythms are built into the spine of Zero Hour, but even just the way they add the great running gag of everyone hating Stryker.
Oh, I'm really so bored by him too. Yeah. And the woman hangs herself listening to his story.
Yeah, he's a hero that nobody likes.
I know, it's true. Like, nobody's into Stryker.
And this time through, I just realized how deeply buried that is. Like, nobody liked him before. Nobody liked him in his crisis. No one is sympathetic to Elaine is kind of, but not really.
No, she's pretty upset for most of it that he followed her. Yeah.
Yeah, she's annoyed. And it's, what is it, 40 years later now almost? And it still lands. Those jokes are really,
it's really
funny.
Yeah, it's nonstop. And I think that you're right. The runners are perfect. The way they keep everything going, they keep everything balanced, and it's nonstop. Another thing I noticed is, like, if they have to do exposition, they never do exposition unless there's something else funny going on in the back of the scene.
Yes.
right? Yeah. So they're always doing a joke. So there's never really a dull moment. Like there's that scene where I believe it's Captain Over and just the pilots discussing the weather. So it's a setup to say that there's going to be bad weather.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, the guy's working on the hood.
Right.
He's popped the hood of the plane and then he's trying to close the hood and he falls off. So that's all going on while they're giving you the boring parts.
Yeah. Or it's even the asylum that's supposed to have all the details about what's wrong with Stryker. And you've got the... I mean, there's actual Ethel Merman moments.
Oh, my God.
They got her in there.
Ethel Merman's in it. I mean, that the asylum actually has one of my favorite jokes of the whole thing, where he's painting. You know, he's trying to stay calm, or he's sort of rattled by this raid over Macho Grande, so they've got him in the hospital. He's painting to kind of, you know, keep his mind, I guess, in a good place. And Elaine comes to see him, and they reveal his painting, and of course it's just the most horrific painting with this army guy with his leg over his neck and an exploding Jeep, and he's holding a baby. Yeah, it's just insane.
Carnage.
But it's total carnage, and it's absurd carnage. But they don't just leave it there. They carry on with the conversation with him and Elaine, and then a couple seconds later you hear, "Hey, Stryker, can I take a break?" And we reveal that it's the actual scene that he's painting. It's not just out of his mind. He's actually staged this in the asylum. So it's sort of like you can't even believe it, you know?
Yeah.
It's so funny. And they compound, like they build on top of each other.
Yeah. It feels improvised more or less. And not in terms of even a given scene, but just the everything in it is a pylon on something else. It's the yes and game. That goes for 90 minutes and is an airplane movie. I mean, they just found a way to pack all this stuff in. And then, I've forgotten the name of the actor who plays Johnny, but when he shows up, and it's halfway through the film easily, right? He's a late addition.
Yes.
But it is an idea too great to not put in.
Yes.
You can just sort of feel them, we can also give him some space. And he becomes the button on three or four different scenes.
Well, yeah, and incredibly, like, for me, when I was, because I was so young when I saw it, he was my favorite part.
Okay.
And I spoke to a friend of mine recently who showed his kids, who were about 8 or 9, Airplane, and I was like, you showed that to them? And I asked him what was their favorite part, and of course it was Johnny. It's the kids thing. It's so absurd. It's sort of like absurd inside the absurd. And of course, at that age, I couldn't get the references of Lloyd Bridges and all this stuff, sniffing glue, you know, which I love now, obviously. Yeah. But.
And Johnny being coded as flamboyantly gay goes right past you.
Right past, too. Yeah.
He's like a children's
entertainer. He's more like a child, You know, and he's making the hat, and he's saying the dumbest thing. So, yeah, that I remember being my favorite character at that age.
Yeah.
Of course, later, you know, McCroskey and, you know, obviously Robert Stack is just so incredible.
I was trying to figure it out, thinking back on it. It's like, I think I knew most of them from TV. I watched television a lot when I was a kid because there was really, you know, it was the 70s. There was literally nothing else to do except go outside, and who's going to do that? I knew a lot of the faces from things, but I was too young to really understand where they fit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the authority that those actors bring worked for me. I assume the same way it probably worked for Paramount. When they're making this movie, that your safety is you're paying a lot of these actors very little because they're session guys now, essentially.
Yeah, that's a good way to put
it. Going through, like, they were all in Columbo and they were doing television, and this came along and we can get them. They're available. Why not? And I remember an interview, I think it was with Abrams somewhere, where he said that it was Lloyd Bridges who didn't know how to play it. And he said, just do it. Just do it the way you would do it. We'll make it funny. And that's the genius of it, right? Like, it creates the context for these straight performances that is hysterically funny.
It's hard to believe because Lloyd Bridges, like, yeah, he feels like a comedian doing it because it's so good.
Upside down by the end of it.
Oh, God. And jumping out the window and, like, you know, and just every moment with him, you know, there's that one where he's ordering everyone to do everything, you know, he's like, go get the weather report, you know, like, I want the radar mask right away. And then his wife calls. He's like, I want the kids in bed by 3. I want He's flawless to me. I can't get over it. But it's something about the Zucker Abrams connection. Like that, you don't actually see that anymore in a lot of the parody films they do.
Oh, God, no, the new ones. I was trying to figure out how, like, at what point it all went to garbage. And I think it was around the movies, Epic Movie. And
yeah, I agree. They're trying to do the same thing, but then you're not casting the same heavyweights. It's a totally different style. And it is a commitment thing to wanting it to be a certain way. Again, look at the score. Like you feel the energy of it. it feels very much like a movie with like this anarchy that you mentioned, right? Yeah. But, you know, there's a joke early on where Stryker's talking about how he, you know, how he first met Elaine and they're in that disco club. And and it's a really rough
Saturday
club.
Fever.
Yeah, and the Saturday Night Fever bit. But he talks about just what a dive it was and what a rough place. And you see a guy getting stabbed and stuff. But then they put these two girl guides in there. And they start a fight over a card game. And right. that is just a stupid joke, to put girl guides, like women dressed in girl guide costumes, in that. Like, ultimately, it's a dumb joke. But they commit so hard. Like, they're actual stunt women.
Yeah,
and their
yeah.
fight is so insane that within seconds, you're completely caught up in it. And they're, like, throwing each other and, like, down the bar and kicking down the stairs. And so it's like that. It's like this commitment to just do a really dumb joke the best way you possibly can,
yeah.
you know? And that's what I love about it.
Well, it won't let you reject it.
Right.
Right? Like, it just barrels through every single possible response, every single possible resistance to... Well, that's not funny. It's like, fuck you. Yes, it is. We're going to keep doing it. We're going to keep doing it until you laugh.
Yes.
And, I mean, I remember thinking, well, not, I don't remember. I was trying to figure out how much of it would still be possible. Because it's not as aggressively misogynist as a lot of the other stuff around that time. There's that early conversation about the loading zones, the white zone,
and, yes.
which immediately, within 5 minutes of starting this film, leads into, you want me to have an abortion.
Oh, this, I know.
And dropping that in 1981 is a pretty big thing.
Yeah, that's
heavy. I don't know if you could pull that joke out now. And in the background, the striker, striker, striker line, which ends with a man belting a woman across the face, that probably wouldn't make it.
Well, they slap the other, remember the lineup to slap the other traveler who's freaking out.
That's right.
And you know, she's the one who's like, Ted or John never drinks coffee at home. That woman, and then she gets hysterical, and then they're all lining up with the bat and the belt or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah, there is quite a lot of abuse in general, and I mean, I think a lot of old comedy stuff has abuse.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I would say, you could definitely make an argument that it's misogynistic. I mean, it is culturally at that time. I can think of so many things that were much more like that.
Sure. And, well, that's it, right? Like, there's a. This film has a good-naturedness behind it somehow
yes.
that a lot of the other ones don't. And that's the thing that didn't carry forward into the other parodies. You know, the Wayans stuff, the Scary Movie films, they double down on gross-out and excess and cruelty in comedy and gay panic jokes and everything else. It's like this, the first two Scary Movies, the second one is... The first one's kind of fun because Anna Faris convinces you that it's okay. She's going along with everything. And the second one just turns into long stretches that replicate other films,
mm-hmm.
which is never what Zucker, Abrams, and Zucker did. They mm-hmm. made their own thing out of the old thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's the question, though, that I have, because I haven't seen Zero Hour, and I believe you have.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes, like, when you know the reference, you go, oh, they're just... lifting this,
right.
but then when you don't know the reference, you think it's sort of clever and creative. I mean, again, I would just say that the Zucker, Abrams, Zucker, it's definitely coming from a different place than the Wayans are, for sure.
Mm.
But
and then the guys who made Meet the Spartans, an epic movie, and those films are just, I'm not even going to say their names, mostly because I can't remember them, but they're beneath contempt. They're simply, hey, Britney Spears.
It's a cash grab because it's in the news or popular or culturally relevant
yeah.
that year.
They
you know?
Parodied the Twilight series with this thing, Vampires Suck. I had to see that. I don't remember any of it except that they couldn't even get actors who kind of looked like them. It was just so lazy and so casually. Date Movie was the other one.
Date Movie,
yeah.
Epic Movie, many.
Meet the Spartans, Vampires Suck. I think there's one more. And then you have... Marlon Wayans going off and making a haunted house and those things where they're just not, there's no inspiration. It's simply feeding on the corpse of something else that was successful.
And I agree. And you know what it is? It's like the Zucker, Abrams, Zucker approach, especially in Airplane, like to me at least, they elevate it to an art form. Like it really truly is. They're trying to make a movie that has the semblance of these things. It has its own dramatic push forward, and yet all this chaos can happen. And they, like I said, they commit to every joke. They're not just, there's nothing that's a throwaway. I mean, it's interesting you said earlier that it feels like improv. I think I'd be very curious to know what the writing sessions were like. I feel like that's maybe where they improv, where they just kept pushing harder more and more. But then to make this movie, it must have been just all technical. Do you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, oh no, you'd have to have everything planned out.
Yeah.
Just the restrictions that they placed on themselves, which then allow them to create these great big play sets, but they're still locked in. You have the inside of an airplane, you have the air traffic center, you have some cars. That's about it, right? There's not much else that you can use.
I was fascinated by that, too. There's sort of an illusion going on because it really does feel like an airport and a plane and all these things. And there's that shot of the plane crashing through the window. I don't know if that was stock footage they got or something. Yeah. But there's some big set pieces.
It felt pretty major, yeah.
Yeah, there's some big set pieces. But I was wondering, you know, it was ultimately, they said, a very low-budget movie. So I was thinking, you know, how could they do that? But I guess they were still a studio film, you know?
Yeah, it's Paramount. They have some access.
Yeah.
And it must make it, I mean, it obviously made it easier to get some of the cast on board, but it still feels like it got away. Like, it feels like, it doesn't feel like it was released. It feels like it escaped. It was so odd that no one knew what to do. Nobody knew how to refer to it. Was it a parody? Was it a spoof? Was it a satire? It's all of those things. And the only thing apparently we could agree on was that we all loved it.
That's the thing. It just hits everyone so big. And it made so much money. It was an instant success. It spoke for itself. And it's a cultural reference to this day. I mean, like, you know, you can just, you know, I'm looking at the picture of the cover here with, what's his name? Autopilot. Yeah. The autopilot.
Because of course it's auto.
Right, of course. But I mean, you know, I've seen that image show up in different things lately or, you know, recently, and people get it. And like you said, what is it, 40 years old or something? So
it's about to be, yeah.
It's about to be 40 years old.
I don't like to think about these things. 37 right now. But yeah, it's...
Did anyone do a parody type film like this before this? I know Woody Allen had done like What's Up Tiger Lily, where he overdubbed another movie.
Yeah, he redubbed the entire film. There's, I mean, there's stuff in, I guess Love and Death is the closest he came because it is a scattershot parody of Russian literature.
Right.
But again, that is so specific and so, it's ludicrous and pretentious. It's funny. I really like Love and Death, but it is the kind of film that's like narrow casting even then, where he's doing that for a very, very small audience. And Sleeper, kinda, sorta.
You can see the gags a little bit. Some of the gags he came up with, Woody Allen, that maybe was an influence, but...
Yeah, they're genre pastiches more than they are specific parodies, I guess. And with this, it's... this is more... I should point out that noise is the dog snoring. If the recorder picks it up.
He's bored.
There are times he is... There was one episode we did one with Scott Thompson where Dexter liked him so much that he basically cuddled up and fell asleep on his chest.
Oh, man.
And you can hear him snoring halfway through the episode and it sounds like I'm bored and going... So that's not what's happening.
I'm jealous of Scott now.
Making himself known.
Dexter didn't really pay too much attention.
Well, it was the old place we had. We had one couch.
Okay.
Small
space. Okay, I see. Good. I feel better.
And meanwhile, just buzzsawing. Weirdly enough...
There he is.
Yeah. The movie I think of now in the most logical inheritor of what Airplane does is Hot Fuzz.
Yes.
Edgar Wright's film, where you have a more conscious conversation going on because the audience is sophisticated enough 25 years on after Airplane to get that the movie is specifically invoking these things in order to send them up later, affectionately, with love. Like, Shaun of the Dead is a zombie movie, but Hot Fuzz is a film with specific parodies,
mm-hmm.
Referencing Bad Boys 2 and Point Break, which are referenced within the film as existing.
Yeah, and like you said, there's a level of sophistication to it, which I think that's maybe the difference, because, as you said earlier, I mean, those parody movies like Epic Movie and whatnot do take sequences or do put specific references, but they're so blunt and boring. But, you know, Shaun of the Dead is making it into its own film, or Hot Fuzz makes it into its own film. So, but yeah, there, again, I just think there is a level of sophistication. It's what's fascinating to me about it is, you know, loving it as a kid in just the most simple way. And then, you know, 40 years later, being able to go like, oh my God, it's so advanced. And so in terms of filmmaking, so technical and, you know, commitment and everything, but there is a level of sophistication. It's not, people always say with comedy, they're always like, you know, if you do a stupid joke, it's really easy to get dismissed and people won't take your thing seriously anymore. Right. But to me, that's what's so great about these guys is it's like they'll go for the dumbest joke, but they do it in such an intelligent way, and you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the by establishing a romantic through line and then complicating it in every way possible by using an existing story, it gives them the spine that justify. Plus the ticking clock, right? The airplane is going to crash and everyone's going to
die. There's a lot of drama, a lot of stakes.
You have an inherent momentum. And I think that was their stroke of genius. Not just that they were going to make another airplane movie. And this is only, you know, it was in production a year after the Concorde Airport 79. That was still a technically viable franchise. They were still making them at Universal.
Right.
So this was arriving. This was, you know, a contemporary product of satire.
It also was, I think, on the heels of a wave of disaster films.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it was definitely in the zeitgeist that way, because that's another one, disaster movie. Didn't they do that?
Yes, and superhero movie.
Right.
And it's the same team. Those are just...
They're just really bad. I think it's also the level of talent, though, that they brought to the table in Airplane. I mean, even Robert Hayes, and recently I remember hearing... I can't remember who the other guy they were going to cast was. It was someone famous.
Oh, yeah.
But they went with Hayes for some reason, because I think they thought he was more emotional, but he's great.
Yeah.
Like, he's just an incredible performance from him.
Yeah, he's beleaguered in a way
that oh my God.
Endlessly adorable.
Yeah.
Even when he's dancing in that disco sequence and he's supposed to be on top of the world, you can sort of see him counting his steps in his head and just being really careful.
But that's, again, a great dance sequence.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got comedy beats. Remember, he throws her up in the air and she doesn't come down.
Yeah. The thing with very the jacket flying off and coming back.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, very technical, very, you know, but... They pull it all off with such... I mean, it just must have been so complicated to do it all. That's what I find so fascinating.
Yeah.
Because it seems like this fun chaos, and yet it must have been so meticulous.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm always thinking about the visual gags in Top Secret that followed, where, you know, you have the giant stamp, and you have the big phone.
The phone.
And all these things. They had to build those. You can't just do that.
Yeah.
And Airplane, I got the sense they were working with a lot of available parts, but they knew where everything went. All the pieces are in place. Everything has to be... I mean, I don't know how many takes they got of everything, but it has to be meticulous so you can go crazy inside of it.
Well, think about how many characters even they have in the film. I mean, most people, once you start to introduce that many characters, like, they start to lose sense of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But they managed to stop and pause with all these characters and just bring this huge tapestry to the table. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, it's got all the frenzy and sort of colliding desire of something like It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, but in a third the time and at double the speed. It's just, it's frenetic. And even, you know, you have these little throwaway characters with the two guys who speak jive, which I remember thinking, I was sort of cringing at the thought of that scene, and they keep their dignity. Like, that's not a bad scene.
I thought about that one, too. Yeah. Like, could you do that today?
Yeah.
And I do think you could.
As I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, because I think if you had two guys in some kind of a hip-hop slang or street slang or whatever that was impenetrable to someone else, you could still do it, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't even really matter if they were black guys. Like, if they were two sort of white guys discussing. You sort of have that sense that you're isolating them, I guess, in the group, and
it comes right up to the edge of othering them.
Yes, absolutely. But it is sort of a fun gag, and they feel like they're in on the gag.
Yeah, because we get to understand what they're saying, we understand that they're kind of amused and frustrated, just like everybody else on the plane. It actually makes them more normal by letting us understand what they're saying, which I think if you left the subtitles out, it would be awful.
Yes.
But by showing us what their intentions are, it's like, oh, no, they're exactly the same as you or I would be in this ridiculous situation. They're probably the calmest people on the plane.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't know, a joke like the Barbara Billingsley or whoever, the mom from Leave It to Beaver, coming up and goes, you know, stewardess, I speak jive.
Yes.
I mean, it's too good. I don't know.
Yeah, it would be Florence Henderson now.
Yeah.
It's someone who we have to recognize and instantly love.
As the perfect mom and very clean and everything, and then suddenly she's speaking jive. I mean, it's just one of those contrasts that makes comedy great.
Yeah. And it's, again, when it happens, it's completely unexpected. It's something that you just, no matter what you think is going to happen in an airplane movie in 1981, that's not it. And that happens over and over and over again. And that's the thing that these guys do that no one else does or did. And still... no one else does, because they've stopped, and now we're sad. Like, David Zucker made a couple of the Scary Movie sequels, and they're fine.
Yeah.
But, and Basketball, and it's, I enjoy Basketball, but that's a film that's a war between the people making it and the guy directing it.
Right.
Like, Stone and Parker clearly did a couple of rewrites, and the styles don't always mesh.
It seems like a different style.
Yeah.
Whereas Hot Shots kind of continued it, because that was Abrams.
Yeah.
And they had some good stuff in those, too, as well.
Yeah, and the Naked Gun movies, which is...
Naked Gun, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the funniest movie starring O.J. Simpson.
Yes, that's indeed.
But that's where we are now, right? Like everything, we're in a place now where everything is really fraught. Comedy is loaded, even more so than it used to be. And retroactively, other things are making it harder to appreciate the things that we had. Airplane sort of sits in a pocket. That and Top Secret, which other than the anal invader scene, I love without reservation. I think Top Secret's their best film. I mean, I'm going to go to the mattresses for that one.
It's a high quality film making because it's period too, right? And everything.
Yeah.
And it's
World War II Elvis spy movie.
Yes.
Val Kilmer being incandescent in his first major role.
Yes.
And the songs are amazing. I have the soundtrack. I love those songs.
Yes.
Again, unironically, they had this bright, shining moment in the 80s where they could do anything they wanted, and they made Police Squad and Naked Gun, the first one anyway, and the others came out in the 90s, but just, this is all, this the Airplane is all of it. It's where it all comes from.
Yes. I mean, well, and of course they took Leslie Nielsen out of Airplane because he was so amazing, and put him in the Naked Gun and Police Squad. I mean, if anyone hasn't seen the Police Squad TV series, which you can see most of it on YouTube, is unbelievable.
Yeah, there's a DVD too with a couple of special features. Only 6 episodes.
Yes.
Obviously, was never going to be long for this world because it was too weird for network.
Yeah.
But you recontextualize that as a feature film and you make 3 of them. They printed money.
Massive hit.
Yeah.
Yeah, huge hit. And I can remember going to see Naked Gun in a theater and right, like just having that communal experience of people like crying, like just absolutely just dying, you know what I mean? And that's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, that was what the first Airplane was for me. The first time I saw it, it was mostly the adults who were just sort of paralytic with laughter because they were getting it on a level I wasn't. And I was, you know, as a tween, it was just like, this is really funny. I'm into this. I will come back and watch for more jokes. And you could go back and movies played forever. I mean, I know it played for months here. I mean, when I saw Empire, it was over almost a year later.
Wow.
And it was the same day. Films just ran because they could. And the last time when I went to see it by myself at the Yorkdale, I was almost alone. It was a matinee at a shopping mall on a weekday. And I could just sort of look at it. I had seen it enough that I was familiar with it, and I was just, maybe this is even the beginning of what I would end up doing, but I wanted to take it apart. I wanted to know why it was funny and understand what it was. And I got distracted and ended up laughing too much.
Well, that's just it. I think, like you said, it's a world, it's like most things, I think, that people make, there's sort of this intangible quality of like, can you just, like you said, you wanted to look at it, like you want to live in it, like you want to sort of explore that world. And Airplane just brings you right in, I think. Don't you think, Norm, too, that like now we could use something like this in our absurd times to really go like heavy with the, you know, we have satire, we have our Colberts and we have all these other things, but to sort of encapsulate the absurd times we live in now, I would love to see someone do something at this level.
Yeah.
And just tear it apart.
What would you do though? Like, where do you even start? That's the problem, right? Because as soon as you think of something insane, it happens. Now.
Yes.
I think we've reached the point where we all have the ability to make things real by worrying about them.
It's weird. I mean, now it is, especially in the Trump administration, it's so much harder to satire anything, to parody anything, because it's real the next day, like you said. Hmm. And the other thing I find about actually nowadays is, you know, trying to come up with ideas or satirical ideas, anything like that, it's almost hard to compete with what reality.
Yeah.
Like, and my own attention is focused a lot on reality. It's like we're all watching the greatest reality show of all time.
Right, and the stakes are, turn it off and it won't stop.
It won't stop. It's on every channel and the stakes are nuclear war. So, you know what I mean? How do you compete with that? But, you know, the satirists right now have more sort of importance, I guess, and more power than, I mean, you can watch Stephen Colbert and get more out of it than watching the news, because the news just, they don't know how to really talk about anything, because they don't want to be they're either too harsh and too kind of reactionary or hysterical, or they're trying to play both sides when they shouldn't even be. Whereas I find satire just cuts to the heart of it, but I'm digressing. All I'm saying
it's all relevant.
It's important these days. And, you know, although these guys weren't doing anything necessarily political, it's just that chaos and anarchy and the willingness to just go so deep on the jokes. I would just love to see someone with that spirit just tackle our times.
Yeah, I worry that the person who does it will be wildly unqualified. Mm-hmm. Like it'll be an accident. No one will see it coming that suddenly this film will arrive that predicts the thing that happens 6 months later. I mean, you know, everybody with Trump, everybody brought up Wag the Dog, which is naive because in Wag the Dog, it's people scrambling to contain a situation. It's not Trump. It's the people around him. And we know that the people around him aren't that bright.
Mm-hmm.
So it's disappointing that fiction is more comforting in that even when it's a satire of a presidency derailed by sexual malfeasance and then the mendacity around that, there's more on the ball because it's a screenwriter who's thought it through than there is in watching people in the real world reacting to it.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of, there was some other perfect example. Shit, what was it? It's gone.
A film?
Yeah, recently too. Actually, weirdly enough, Parker and Stone with That's My Bush, that show they came up with in early 2001.
Okay.
Where George Bush, it was a sitcom that they said that whoever won the election, they pitched Comedy Central on a sitcom about that president. So it would be either Gore or Bush just bumbling around playing the role of a suburban house husband who's also the president. So every now and then he would talk to his neighbor like Wilson from Home Improvement, and then he would have awkward dinners with the kids and one of them would want to be a rebel about something. And then it was Bush. So that just led to kind of a perfect format because he's already this genial doofus.
Mm-hmm.
And then 9/11 happened. It's like, well, we can't do this anymore. And they just shut the show down.
Right.
But that was kind of on the ball of understanding a persona so well that you can build a show around it while still telling the truth about this guy, which is that he's in over his head. He's wildly unqualified. He probably shouldn't be president. But, you know, it was the whole thing extrapolated from he seems like a really nice guy to have a beer with.
Right.
And you couldn't do that with Trump.
Well, that's a weird thing. Actually, they're doing, right? Colbert's doing a...
Everybody, there's a cartoon. There's the President Show with Tony Adam.
Yeah.
And there, I haven't seen the Colbert cartoon yet, but
yeah.
The President Show is really good, but it's not funny.
Yeah.
It's horrifying. It's
yeah.
great at showing you the id and the neediness, and it becomes, like, his Trump is a tragic, occasionally self-aware monster.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. It's riveting. I saw him do it live with James Adomian 2 years ago before the election.
Right, which is how they... Because he was doing Bernie.
Trump versus Adomian. Bernie, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was an incredible show. It ended with Adam Maniac reading a poem as Trump, and it's just, I am chaos, I am destruction, I will ruin everything, and you're going to let me. And everything about it was right. Everything
yeah.
he saw into his soul found this little marble and just choked on it.
Well, the crazy thing about Trump is that everybody knows who he is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's still endlessly fascinating as a character because you just can't believe that he's gotten away with it, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, everyone's like, you know, other people would be sunk by this point. Like, if a porn star came out, other presidents would be sunk. It's like, yeah, because we all know Trump's a piece of shit. Like, he's set the bar so low.
Yeah, there's no bottom.
So there is no bottom. I saw, actually, it was a great comment the other day. Someone was like, rock bottom, where the hell are you? But it's true. Like, there is no bottom. So, but that's not a good place to be. Like, it's like, oh, yeah, like, we're not upset that he slept with a porn star because we already expected that he's such a, you know, piece of garbage. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when that's your sort of going mentality, that's a horrible place to be. It's almost like, I don't even know if people want to see political satire or something. Like, it's almost like everyone's like, enough.
Yeah.
I'm also just talking about myself and what I want to see and whatnot. Like, I want to see that. But then at the same time, what's the thing that's going to kind of, like, what's, I don't know, just like bring us all together in sort of a grand scheme, not just analyzing the politics. Does that make sense? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by it now because, like, I could watch political satires all day, but when you look at a greater cultural impact, you're just looking across the board. And, I mean, we started this discussion about Airplane.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I was thinking it has no political compass.
It really doesn't, except for, again, like, I think all these sort of aggressive male guys who are just sort of, like, more pig-headed and doing things for their own reasons, which... I guess in the end they do get the plane down, but Kramer's just such a jerk.
Yeah.
And but you're right. There's nothing. I would say it's really apolitical. There's nothing really going on there.
Yeah. It's a crisis, and I mean, we kind of the ending is never in doubt. I don't think it was ever going to crash.
No.
And I don't think you could even do that now in a parody where everybody dies.
Or really in a movie. I mean, that in a mainstream movie, let's say. You know?
Yeah, no, I mean, the objective is the rescue, the safe landing, the salvation.
It's just how they get there, I guess. And And they did it great. Look, they got us there. I mean, all the sweat coming down, or they did that whole gag. Yeah. Like, they did, they, that moment when he was landing the plane is everything, you know? So
yeah,
they really did ramp it up.
It's to the point where the only other time I've seen a similar scene since is that Kurt Russell Halle Berry movie, Executive Decision, where he has to land the plane. It's a straight film. It's not a comedy. I mean, it's kind of, it's eccentric, but he's an anti-terrorist expert who's recruited onto this mission. He shows up in a tuxedo because they basically pick him up outside of a dinner. And Steven Seagal is leading the mission, and the big twist is that Seagal gets killed.
Oh.
15 minutes in. Like, he's not, he doesn't make this elaborate plane-to-plane transfer. He doesn't make it. The rest of the team is injured. I want to say Oliver Platt or John Leguizamo, somebody in there is, like, basically the expert is tranquilized halfway through because he breaks his back, and it all comes down to Russell saving the day from these terrorists who are going to release nerve gas all over the Eastern Seaboard from a 747.
Obviously.
But the big scary moment is that Kurt Russell, who's only ever flown a prop plane, I think, has to be talked down to land the plane with Halle Berry, who's one of the stewardesses, and it's just, you can't take it seriously. It's supposed to be the climax of the film, and I'm just like, no.
Yeah.
This is, how did you not know that 25 years ago there was a movie that did this better and funnier?
That's the funny thing, because you're getting all the drama out of the situation, even though it's absurdly hilarious.
Yeah.
It's the music, too, right? It's everything. Like, they're putting it all together, and you know, Kramer going, down, down, and, you know, he's pushing it down, and he's sweating. So you're right, it does amp it up. As you said that, I was thinking of the Denzel Washington movie Flight, too.
Right, which has its plane crash in the first act, so at least it gets it out of the way.
Yes, but, and then he flips the plane over and all this stuff, so I guess it was a spin on it. Interesting film also. You know, I found it interesting anyway, but definitely the drama in Airplane, as you say, I'm just sort of processing this as you said it. It is true that you're getting that need. It's like you're scratching that itch.
Yeah, no, all the parts are moving.
Yeah.
Like, all the things are doing what they're supposed to do, but they're also really funny.
Yeah.
If you have any... I'm trying to think... Oh, I don't remember where I heard it, but it's obviously true. They said that their nod to Zero Hour was that the prop plane noise is played over every shot of the plane flying. You're not hearing jet engines, you're hearing a prop plane. And I think... because that was the original film, was a smaller plane with prop engines.
Okay.
And I think that helps so much in unconsciously just telling people, don't worry about things.
Yes.
It creates a discordant note every time the plane, they cut back to that exterior and you hear instead of a jet sound. And you can just, your brain is going, well, that's not right.
That's right. I guess, yeah, it's funny because, you know, sound is... To me, I came from Chum, actually. I worked in the Chum days, and there was
I didn't know that.
The head of sound, Bob Cook, back then. You know, of course, he was the head of sound, so he was biased, but he would always be like, sound is 60% of the game, you know? And he would always get really angry about it. But he is right, and sound does so much subconsciously. I mean, I was thinking about that watching... I thought even The Force Awakens to The Last Jedi, the sound took a nosedive. Like J.J. Abrams got it more right, and it hit you in that emotional place. Sound, yeah. Just those sounds. And like, do you remember in the first Star Wars, The New Hope or whatever, just the battle at the end with the X-Wing fighters, and they had all the, it was more like a dogfight.
Yeah,
and
like, laser crossfire everywhere, yeah.
All those little sounds and the rickety buckets. Those things like create this sort of emotion. Now, to your point, I think you're probably exactly right. They're exaggerating the soundtrack. So on a subconscious level, you know that it's not realism.
Yeah.
But yet, because the sound is all there, it still grabs you in a way, you know? I don't know.
Well, the score is definitely working overtime to be a real musical score for a thriller. And it's a great score.
It's an amazing score.
It's a really lively, fun, brassy score.
Yeah, and I mean, think about how it muscles through all that stuff at the airport at the beginning with their little theme song that they keep repeating.
Yeah.
And yet it takes you through all those jokes. Like, not every score can support humor the same way and be serious.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's quite fascinating.
Watching Ghostbusters again a couple of years ago, which is also an Albert Bernstein score, that score is way more jokey.
Yes.
And it's working in a way that the movie isn't.
Quirky, yeah.
Yeah, because it's bouncing and it's got horns, things like that. And the movie is this kind of dirty, gritty New York look.
Agreed.
Where they are not playing it for... laughs.
Yeah, and I would argue that that's one of the weaker points of Ghostbusters is that, and I feel like that's Reitman, who's a little bit quirkier in his sensibilities.
Yeah, it's like he didn't trust the cut.
Yeah,
when he saw it, except that the score, the song is terrific. The musical score is actually like it's fighting with the soundtrack, which is more poppy and has the right tone. It's sort of looser and goofier.
Yeah.
And the score is just trying really hard to get you to the big moments.
To get you to those horror moments. Yeah. Like it suddenly goes into horror. It's not consistent through the whole thing.
That's where, it,
yeah. The airplane score really powers you through the entire movie.
But without ever joking about it.
Without ever joking. And you don't really notice. You're not like, oh, there's a lot of score here. But it's so well done.
Yeah, by playing it straight, it sells the comedy. It's amazing.
One of the things I was going to bring up with you is Airplane 2.
I was wondering if we should even... Because it's so inferior.
It is, but what's interesting is they got... Okay, now again, I watched these when I was a little kid.
Oh, I saw this in the theater too.
So, but I didn't learn until I was older that Ken Finkelman did it. And Ken Finkelman, of course, being the great Canadian writer, producer, and
comedy
director.
Legend. Yep.
Comedy legend. He did The Newsroom on CBC and a couple of other big things.
Oh, yeah. Four or five, I think, over the last few years.
Yeah. Very strange guy in person.
I don't think we've ever met.
I went out for coffee with him, or for a drink with him, and, you know, looking for some advice, you know, a few years back and whatnot, on just, you know, because I thought he was a very successful guy, and I was inspired by him and the fact he did Airplane 2, I'd found out, and all this stuff. But, yeah, he's not really an advice kind of guy.
Okay.
He regaled me with stories of his Hollywood days and whatnot. But, And he had quite a successful career as a screenwriter. There's no question. I mean, he was in this building at Paramount and all this stuff. But anyway, he did Airplane 2. Part of the reason I got to meet him was I had worked with his nephew on a project. And his nephew told me that when he was a kid, he'd walk, you know, he'd go visit his uncle and he'd have like just a $100,000 check sitting on his desk from Airplane 2 residuals. Jesus. Like just lying around. And he was like, oh, what's this? Oh, no, you know, throw it on the other side. But I think he made a bundle of money. It's a big thing to step into.
Yeah.
After Zucker, Abram Zucker. And in a way, I mean, to me, he pulled it off being a little kid, but I haven't watched it in 25 years. So
yeah, it does not hold up. It's no. I mean, so much of it, too, is the it leans into the things that Airplane did effortlessly, just casting William Shatner and putting him in space. And doing all of, I mean, just going, you don't go to space until the fourth movie. That's the rule. I don't know why they did this in the second one, but it jumps too far too fast and it's too ambitious without really understanding what made the original so great. It sort of prefigures a bunch of the Scary Movie sequels in that, well, we're going to do these things that we vaguely recognize that the kids like. Mm-hmm. And Airplane is definitely, I mean, kids can appreciate it as we both proved, but it holds up because it's made for adults. It's made for people who understand the material and enjoy the tweaking while still being able to appreciate what works about it. And Airplane 2, it's the same situation with different characters, it's the same situation in a different location, the same characters, the same problems, and none of them, there's no advancement. The new characters are very silly.
Well, sometimes actually when I thought back, I think a joke is from Airplane and then it's like, oh no, it's Airplane 2.
Yeah, yeah.
So they did have quite a few gags. I mean, I told my daughter about that, you know, just these dumb lines where it's like, remember Elaine has a new boyfriend?
I don't remember.
Anyway, he gets into a conflict with Ted Stryker in the cockpit and he's like, Stryker, I'd watch my step if I were you. And then he walks out the door and falls down a set of stairs.
See?
You know, like, but that's a great, it
if
was
you're
great.
A kid, that's funny.
I assure.
As an adult, it just feels hacky.
Yeah, I guess so.
Because the one thing about Airplane is that it doesn't do the thing you expect.
Yeah.
When it sets up a joke, it goes sideways.
Yes and no, but I mean, they still have dumb lines in Airplane. Who's kidding who? You know, like,
Well, the Shirley Runner.
The Shirley Runner, though, but the Shirley Runner is great in its own way.
Yeah.
But when, you know, it's like, oh, they're using instruments and then they're playing in a band.
That's true,
or they're like...
It's like almost Dada.
Yeah.
Just that weird pun follow, like a visual pun.
Let's just find every place to pop something in, you know? And also, though, yeah, I do have respect for that because there's a layering to it in comedy where you're just trying to find more and more jokes. Mm-hmm. Another influence, actually, I think that Airplane... gave to you was The Simpsons. Like, The Simpsons,
very
much influenced by that style of Zucker, Abram Zucker.
And the pacing is very much.
Pacing and the way they cut away to visual jokes and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the absurd, but they maintain sort of a storyline. So, but yeah, I don't know. Now I'm going to have to see Airplane 2 again, but that's for another podcast.
Oh, don't do that. Just remember it the way you remember it. It's probably funnier. Okay. I was going to ask you, do you have a single favorite line? Because mine has always been... The thing that has stuck with me forever, which is Leslie Nielsen saying, Was it? It was either the chicken or the fish, and he just says, "I had lasagna."
Yeah.
It makes no sense. It's so wonderful, and that's what I mean about swerving. It just, that is not the answer you thought he would give.
Yeah, and he just, but that's the thing. What's so beautiful about those movies is you can just get away with it. Nobody's sitting there going, "Wait a sec, there was no lasagna on the menu."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You've accepted the premise that everything's so crazy that you can just go with it.
And he delivers it with such authority that, again, you just wouldn't question it.
Oh yeah, he delivers everything with such authority.
Yeah.
Wow, it's hard to pin it down to a particular line. I mean, it's got to be something from McCroskey or Kramer, I would think. The Lloyd Bridges or the Robert Stack character. Mm-hmm. I used to love so much the speech that Kramer gets at the end. You know, he's like, you know, Stryker's like, that was some of the worst flying I've ever seen. But there's some of us down here would like to buy you a drink and, you know, hand you a cigar. And then, you know, he just takes off the headphones, he leaves, and then you just hear Kramer go, "Because you know, Ted, when the going got tough," and he's still going on, and then we cut back to him three times, and he's still, "Christmas, Ted, what did that mean to you?" For me, that was a living hell. You ever get thrown down the mud and kicked in the head with an iron boot? Of course he didn't. That never happened.
Right.
No, nobody did that. Scratch that. Forget that. Like, just totally absurd going on, and I don't know, man. It just, it's every moment. I found it to be, which is rare in comedy, a cumulative effect. You know, they get you with the one, and then it starts to compound, and that's the best kind of comedy. When you go see a great stand-up who has great rhythm, that's what'll happen. You know, you're already still laughing from the first one, and then they push it further and further.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what this movie does for me. I mean, I started to go, I watched it about a month ago again, I started to go right when the White Zone and Red Zone thing, which actually, little piece of trivia I found out there is that's a real couple that did White Zone and Red Zone announcements.
I didn't know that.
At airports.
They were probably cheaper than others, right? Like, it's less than scale.
How crazy is that, though? And then they have this whole discussion, and then that's going on in the background, like you said, about the abortion and everything. And, of course, he leaves that guy in the taxi, which they keep.
That's right. That's the last shot in the film, right?
Last shot in the film. He's still in the cab. They keep that runner loyal. But it's a compound cumulative effect, and it just keeps going and going. So I'm just endlessly impressed by just the craftsmanship of it as a comedy.
Yeah. Oh, I can't blame you. It's something. It really still is. So this does bring us to the final question of the podcast, which is there anything of Airplane specifically that you've borrowed or stolen or referenced or incorporated into your creative DNA?
I think so. Like, that's what kind of occurred to me, you know, watching it again, was that, you know, I didn't think I had really. I mean, I've always been a comedy guy, but I think it's that tone. And I wouldn't say I've got it just yet, but I've sort of internalized it, and I've been looking for it my whole life.
Yeah.
Is just that tone where things are completely absurd, and you have the freedom to just kind of, like you said, he can just say lasagna, and it's okay.
Yeah.
But then a sense of realism at the same time. Like, I'm not a huge fan of stuff that's just absurd for absurdity's sake. Like, I like it when it's brought down to a realistic level, and it's not winking at the audience, and it's deadpan. So I think really the tone of Airplane is something that's just kind of innate now inside me, and it's like what I want to see in some other format.
Right.
I don't know if it would be a complete satire movie or if I could even pull that off, but that tone of sort of, I call it like absurd realism, is sort of what I'm going for. And there's slight elements of that in Phil City, maybe, where things get a little bit too weird, but we try to keep it real, you know? So that's what I take from it.
Oh, reality is usually funnier.
Reality, well, yeah, what's the twain? Truth is stranger than fiction, because fiction has to make sense.
Yeah, nothing makes sense anymore.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It doesn't make sense anymore. So now
we all just accept it.
Yeah. So now that's the question. So what does fiction become?
Stranger.
It's even stranger.
Yeah. God help us all.
Yeah. It's God help us all, Norm. That's one way to go out.
Yeah, that's a perfect ending.
As the cover of Airplane, the poster says, thank God it's only a movie.
My thanks to Andy King, who reprises the role of J.D. Castlemaine opposite Morgan Waters in the fourth season of The Amazing Gale Pyle, going live on CBC Digital this Thursday, March 29th. You can check out the first three seasons right now at cbc.ca/watch, and you should do that. It's fun, it's weird, and it's got lots of great cameos. Thanks also to Anne Vranich. She knows what she did. You can find Andy on Twitter at AndyKin9, AndyKin, numeral 9. And you can find Airplane on Blu-ray and DVD from Paramount Home Entertainment. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play, But you should get the Blu-ray, and you should make sure you get the Don't Call Me Shirley Special Edition, which has this nifty pop-up track with interview clips and stuff. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner, and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps, it really does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.